Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So let's start with a discussion of what happened at the Senate and the very, very interesting bill that finally got passed. Interesting, I think, more in what it teaches us about government, but there are some substantial things here. So let's go back and go back to what the House passed and just kind of cover that one, because now we have a bill from the House and a bill from the Senate, and now it all goes to conference committee. And whenever they publish who's in that conference committee, if you happen to be a constituent of that individual, might be good to start writing letters, because that is really where the healthcare policy for the next decade is going to be, is what they hammer out in that conference committee. So, the House bill, we had an employer mandate. Without going into details, employers had to pay for health insurance if their payroll was at least $500,000. They're exempt if it's smaller than that. There was also an individual mandate. Individuals have to buy health insurance on 2013 or pay a 2.5 surtax on their gross income, and that'll be handled by the IRS, and you know they've got their enforcers. The House bill also included subsidies for families up to 400% of the federal poverty level. It required health insurance to put no exclusions on pre-existing conditions. That didn't start till 2013, by the way. Limits out-of-pocket expenses to $5,000 for an individual, $10,000 for a family, presumably that's per year. Prohibits lifetime payment limits, reduces inequities on premiums based on age, and no more rescinding coverage except in cases of fraud by the consumer. The big important distinction was the public option. The House did mandate a government run public health insurance plan to be administered through HHS. And it also established a federal health insurance exchange for each state that will list all available insurance providers and allow people to purchase insurance from the exchange and small businesses also. It was going to close the donut hole in Medicare Part D, that was the drug payment, and it was going to expand eligibility to Medicaid. Now, the Senate health care bill that was passed this last week does create some significant changes. I think the most important thing that it does, really, from my perspective, is it does take away the pre-existing condition. In other words, if you might need to use your health insurance, we won't sell it to you because you might become a cost center. They won't be able to do that. If the privilege of selling insurance is going to include the obligation of taking anybody who wants it, and they will not be able to charge higher premiums because of gender, health history, or occupation. Insurers will also be prohibited from dropping people when they get sick. No mention of the issue of fraud and whether they can just say, well, you lied on your application, which is the current dodge. I'm sure that that is mentioned in the 1,300-page bill that just got passed, but you'll forgive me if I haven't had a chance to review the whole document. There will be no more lifetime limits on coverage, and annual limits will be restricted. Insurances will be required to cover preventative health care. So pretty much the same set of conditions there. One thing I really liked about the Senate bill that isn't in the House bill is that insurance companies will be required to show that they spend a minimum of 85 cents of every premium dollar on actual medical care, as opposed to, oops, well, we just spent 35% on advertising and expenses and administration, and I guess that leaves 65% for healthcare. But oh well. So they won't be able to do that anymore. And 85% is actually quite generous. These guys have been profiteering for quite a while. This will help hospitals who spend a lot of money paying for uncompensated care and passing that charge through to the consumer and then spending more money collecting from the insured consumers. So a lot of wheel spinning and wasted motion, maybe some savings there. There is no public option in the Senate health care bill, but there is an exchange. Small businesses will have access to state-based insurance exchanges where they can shop for policies. Federal subsidies will be available to people purchasing coverage through the exchanges, and the exchanges are supposed to be up and running by 2014. So hold your breath. Can you hold your breath for 4 years? Maybe. Anyway, that's how long you're going to have to hold your breath. Neither of these bills really does anything to reduce cost because neither of them really addresses the issues of how are we spending money well? Should we be spending money differently? And are, in fact, we spending a lot of money on stuff that hasn't been shown to have any consumer benefit? That's going to be the debate for the next decade, say 2014 to 2024. And, you know, eventually we may get around to having an actual coordinated healthcare system, probably about the time I'm going to retire, I'm guessing. A little word from the Journal of the American Medical Association. There was a nice editorial dated December 16th, just before this passed, but obviously they were thinking about it. And the author, Michael Gray, points us in the direction of the FSA, which is the Farm Security Administration. This existed between 1932 and 1947, and I didn't know this, but there's a nice little history in this two-page commentary. But the FSA was put together during the Depression to loan money to farms that were kind of on the ropes, very similar to the housing situation, except it was farmers. And they had a healthcare benefit included in it. And essentially, it was a collective that contracted with rural physicians and paid medical bills out of the system, out of this Farm Securities Administration. Your payment of your loan also included a health insurance benefit because they thought, you know, maybe if people stayed healthy, they wouldn't default on their loans. Interesting concept. They were thinking back then, weren't they? Anyway, FSA cooperatives ultimately failed. And the reason they failed was that they couldn't get big enough and they couldn't have the demographic mix that would have made them a durable system. By limiting the cooperatives to states, we're going to see failures. We're going to see failures in the states that have small populations. In a state like California or Texas, where you have a large population, many of them independent entrepreneurs who can't afford to buy their own health insurance because of pre-existing conditions, these reforms will make a big difference. And I can anticipate the emergence of formidable and powerful purchasing collaboratives or cooperatives in large population states. But in small states, like Rhode Island, for example, or underpopulated states like Montana, it's unlikely that there will be able to be enough people involved in the pool to spread the risk and to give it the kind of purchasing power that has allowed for leverage against the large insurance companies, which unfortunately we still need because we haven't done away with the large insurance companies in our quote-unquote healthcare reform. Well, let's just reframe it. Let's call it Health Insurance Abuse Elimination Bill. Let's call it that. That's what it is. It eliminates the worst abuses of the health insurance industry. That's it. It's a victory of sorts, but compared to the hopes that many of us had a year ago, it's something of a Pyrrhic victory. Take a deep breath. The new year is coming, and we need to focus on the positive. So how about some emails? I had some interesting emails over the last 2 weeks, and we've gotten a little bit backlogged. This one from Andrea in Santa Cruz. Dear Dr. Dawn, my friend wakes up many times during the night, sometimes almost every hour. He's a 46-year-old recovering alcoholic, sober 2.5 years, smokes, eats a reasonably healthy diet, but eats most of his daily intake in the evening. He always wakes up hungry, eats, and goes back to sleep again. Works hard and exercises, takes magnesium and melatonin before bed. I read that cysteine milk peptide could help detoxify and improve sleep. What do you think? Or do you have any other suggestions? Thanks for your help. Always enjoy your show. Andrea. Well, Andrea, first of all, you're correct. Sleep is when you detoxify from chemicals and substances, and that would include alcohol. That's probably why alcohol is so significant for disrupting sleep. But if you've been 2.5 years sober, that's probably not your issue. You mentioned cysteine milk peptide. The cysteine is probably the active ingredient there. Cysteine is a precursor for the molecule glutathione, and glutathione is used for detoxification. It's an extremely important component for the elimination of toxins, and therefore, it's very important to have a good supply of it if your body is having to detoxify drugs or detoxify hormone disruptors or detoxify little fragments of plastic and pesticide and like that pink stuff they were spraying on the side of the field while I was driving to work. And I looked down and I was so happy that the car was on internal recirculate because it was way too fast to hit the button before I passed that stuff. Who knows what it was? Anyway, my body will be doing a little detoxifying tonight, no doubt. In the case of your friend, I think his issue is probably blood sugar. You mentioned that he eats most of his intake in the evening and then wakes up hungry. Because he was an alcoholic for some years, that probably put a strain on his pancreas. And I suspect that what is occurring in the case of your friend is that he's having blood sugar fluctuations over the night because he ate too many calories all at once. And that led to an increase in insulin, perhaps an overshoot, and then a rapid drop in blood sugar, which wakes him up, and he goes through that cycle. Very important for your friend to try. And if he makes it a project to do it for a week, I think he'll see benefit if I'm on the right track here. And that would be to take those calories and divide them up into frequent small meals. Just for a week, try to go no more than 3 hours without eating something. Make sure that the last thing he eats before bedtime is protein with no carbohydrate in it and see if he can get some improvement there. I have a related email from Lori in Palo Alto. At least I think it's related. Night sweats after hip replacement surgery. 3 weeks ago, I had hip replacement surgery. Everything's gone smoothly except a continuing problem with night sweats 3 to 4 times each night. The doctors originally speculated that the problem was caused by a drug reaction. I am no longer on any pain relievers other than Tylenol. The only drug I take is levothyroxine, which I've taken daily for years after a thyroidectomy. We've tested for infection, thyroid function, and cortisol levels. All are normal. One other note, I've not had a fever. She's had 2 mastectomies and a hysterectomy, all done several years ago. Any ideas of what might be causing this? Yeah, Lori, I think you're actually probably still detoxifying from your drugs because you mentioned that you're still taking Tylenol. And my bet is, several weeks after a hip replacement surgery, you're probably taking a fair amount of Tylenol. And Tylenol is actually a fairly difficult drug for the liver to detoxify. And you may be between the Tylenol and just the residua of the anesthetics that were used, which, by the way, are fat-soluble and dissolve into your body fat and then take weeks to be completely eliminated, although certainly the bulk of them are eliminated in the first few days. Nevertheless, if you have certain variations in the way your body processes drugs and you're taking a lot of acetaminophen, those two things together could be enough, plus the anesthetic drugs, to be causing you to still have a detoxification reaction, which is very commonly manifesting as a night sweat. So I don't know if it's possible for you to stop your Tylenol completely, maybe switch for a short period of time to a non-steroidal, or maybe do without painkillers at this point and just use natural anti-inflammatories like high-dose fish oil and curcumin. But in the short run, if you can't do those things and you still need the Tylenol, no caffeine, no alcohol, and maybe think about going to an acupuncturist because there are some tonification treatments that are not drug-related that can be used to help with liver functioning, and that might be useful in this context. Let's go to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have some comments relative to the issues at hand in the government.
Love to hear them.
Number one, they aren't talking about health insurance. They're talking about sick insurance. You know, when you look at something from a skewed point of view, well, then how can you deal with it directly? Anyway, sick insurance is what's costly, in my point of view. Health insurance, our health would be related to the food you take in, the exercise that you do, the stretching and things like that. That's one point. So let's redirect it to what's really costly. I know this person, she had a inflammation in her foot, and it was causing pain, and her doctor prescribed an ankle brace for her. She showed me the ankle brace that she only wore twice because it was so painful. It was a custom-made ankle brace. It cost her $1,700 for the ankle brace. That's insanity. You could go down to the local pharmacy, horse night or something like that, and get one, okay, maybe that the insurance industry should be non-profit, because right now it's legalized gambling.
It used to be not-for-profit. Ronald Reagan changed that in 1988. It was called the Knox-Keene Act.
A lot of this debate would be non-existent if they were non-profit.
I disagree with you on that, but go ahead. Yeah, I do. The reason I say that is because, naming no names, some of the most abusive groups that I'm aware of are technically not-for-profit.
Okay, well, then that comes in regulation, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Exactly. What does not-for-profit exactly mean? Does it mean that you're allowed to pay $11 million to your chief executive officer? Because, hey, you're a not-for-profit. But,
that's
that's what a good CEO costs nowadays on the open market, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We got to do something with that.
All the CEOs agree that that's what a good CEO costs.
Yeah. What's your opinion relative to linking the insurances with your employer? I know that came about with Kaiser, didn't it, back in World War II or something of that nature?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Why have they linked insurance to your employer?
It's a historical accident, and you're right, it does relate to World War II. Right after World War II, Harry Truman actually had a national health care bill. It went down in flames. I think that was 1947. But what happened during World War II was that there was a shortage of workers, and there was a government-imposed ban or upper limit on salaries. So you weren't allowed to pay people more in order to compete for workers. And so what people did was they started competing in the benefits market. So free health insurance, free life insurance, you get the idea. It's just going around the government regulation that says you can't raise wages. This was to prevent inflation, because we were in a war economy and there was a huge demand for workers, and et cetera, et cetera. So, real primitive kind of market control regulation, which, set us up for this. And then very quickly, these companies grew to have significant political influence. And so they liked it that way. They liked having the employee mandate, because if the employers are purchasing it, then by definition, the people that you're going to get are people who are actually going to work, who will tend to be healthier and will tend to cost you less. And you get the idea.
The aspect of insurance getting in between you, the doctor, and the patient, that's what bugs me most.
You and me both. Okay, so we're not going to solve any of these things. You're absolutely right. None of these things are even being remotely addressed here. And what we've got right now with the addition of this new legislation, what concerns me most is that we have a trend. We have a runaway train right now in medical care. It goes back to the old market adage, you get what you pay for, right? It's supposed to mean, quality, that you spend more money, you get something better. But it also means that if you are paying for something, whatever that something is, there will be more of it available. More people will try to make it and give it to you. And we have a system right now where there's just this amazing collusion going on. It's part of the Medicare system, and it works with the AMA. And basically, there's this committee of people who are not appointed, who are not elected. They're employed by their various specialty societies, and they decide what Medicare is going to pay for services. And they will, and it's just like what we just saw in the Senate. I mean, you want to see how politics works. This passed because Joe Lieberman, who was a swing vote, could basically insist on a lot of favors. Down the line, Joe Lieberman's going to want something, and he's going to get it with someone who doesn't really want to vote for it because he voted for this, and that's how it works in Washington. Well, in this committee, the specialties are divided up such that if you're a proceduralist, like gastroenterologist, cardiologist, people who nowadays do a lot of procedures, you get a vote. Your representative gets a vote. If you're an internist, which means you don't do procedures, you just sit there and talk to patients and check their blood pressure and counsel them on diet and exercise, a general internist, well, you get one vote. So if you start counting it up, people who do procedures have way more votes, and they sit down and they say, well, procedures are worth a lot, right? Right. Well, if you agree that my procedure is worth this, then I'm going to agree that your procedure is worth that. And as far as the people who just do brain work and mouth work and the humdrum keeping the patients healthy work, we have very few votes in terms of how that's valued. And since everything is based on Medicare in terms of how the insurance companies reimburse, what we have is this completely distorted situation where I can spend 45 minutes with a person working with them on their diabetes at a very, very deep complex level, explaining the whole process, how they need to eat, how to do their insulin, the whole thing. And I might make as much doing that from Medicare as I would make doing a 5-minute skin biopsy. Because biopsies are procedures, and procedures are very, very overwhelmingly paid for. So to get back to your friend with the ankle brace, the custom procedure of fitting her and building this device, whether it worked or not, doesn't matter. The entity would tell you that. Medicare would say, it doesn't matter whether it worked or whether the patient used it. What matters is that the input of time and education and facilities and yada, yada, yada justifies the cost. You see? So everybody's in bed with everybody else in terms of the proceduralists, and they outvote the people who are just trying to do good health care.
So then how do we get past all the things of that nature?
Indeed. Who bells the cat? Remember that old Aesop fable?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. How do we get past this is national health care? Because the only way to get past it is if the government actually has an incentive to say no. And the only way you get, very obviously, the only way that you get the Senate to do anything is to make it financial. If we have a budget and people are demanding preventative health care services, then they'll find a way to balance the budget by reducing the cost of the procedures. And if you reduce the cost of the procedures to the point that the procedures are no longer so desirable to perform, then doctors won't perform them as readily. They'll take a wait-and-see approach because it's not a profit center for them to be doing procedures.
It was not procedures from a certain point in time, and then it switched to procedures, correct?
Well, what happened is when Medicare was set up, it created this bias. It created an evolutionary pressure, just like in any complex system you have evolutionary pressures, and the evolutionary pressure essentially reinforced procedures rather than non-procedures. So anything that could be a device or anything that could be a surgery, you got paid better. And so doctors are the ones who are making the purchase decision. Imagine you went into a store to buy a shirt, and the sales clerk looked you over, took your employment history and said, you know, you really, in your position, you really must have the $200 custom-made shirt. That's really what you need. It just so happens that I have a tailor right here, and we'll get that done for you, and we'll bill your credit card, not to worry. This is the problem with having a broken feedback loop. If we had a system where people had a price tag and they looked at it and said, you know, I think I'm going to go see what they've got over at the drugstore and see if maybe I should spend $40 rather than $2,000 on this because I'm not sure it's going to work. And, you know, if I get a little bit better with the $40 version, I'll think about the $2,000 version. But we don't do it that way. And until we do it that way, we're going to have an irrational system.
Given that not-for-profits might not be the best, or a not-for-profit would be different than something like a credit union would be, where people go in, form a group. Would that, in my mind, that would be different than a non-profit. Is that true?
It would be different. I don't think it gets to the core issue.
Oh, okay.
And,
okay.
You know, design the perfect healthcare system in 3 sentences or less. How about if we did this? How about if everybody had insurance, and in order to be fully insured, it was paid for outside of your money. You weren't going to have more or less money. You have the insurance. If you actually do your health maintenance, whatever the think tank has decided is optimum health maintenance, it's pap smear every 3 years, mammogram every year after 50, prostate check, colonoscopy, whatever screening things, and plus you meet the following health markers, so you're a good citizen. You know, your cholesterol is controlled. If it isn't controlled, you show up for your follow-up visit. So you're a good health citizen. Let's just frame that as what it would mean. So in that circumstance, there's some sort of kickback to you. You're still fully insured, but if you meet these parameters and you're doing a good job, that keeps the cost for the system down. So you get some kind of refund, like a tax refund at the end of the year, if you meet those parameters. Now, on the other hand, if you smoke or you don't come in for your doctor's visits or your hypertension isn't controlled, you know, I'd like to have people coming and knocking on my door saying, doctor, my hypertension's not controlled, help me, rather than chasing them to say, Jack, your hypertension's not controlled, let me help you. That's ridiculous. I mean, they should be coming to me so that I can help them be healthier. I shouldn't have to be running after people trying to sell the concept of being healthier. And if we need to monetize that to get people to have a clue, well, then maybe we do. Anyway, enough of pie in the sky utopias. Any last comments before we go to our break?
That should do it. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And I want to point out that we've never spoken before. I did not ask you to call in and provide
true.
Such a great interlocutor for this discussion. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I have a caller on line 3. I'm sorry, I don't have your name.
Yeah, Scott.
Scott.
My name's Scott.
Hi, Scott.
Yeah.
What can I do for you?
I talked to you a few weeks ago. I've got CLL, and it's very obviously in its last stages. I was trying to worm a date out of you. You know, I want somebody to tell me exactly how long I've got, because I have my 9-year-old son who has arrangements have been made for, but, you know, I want everything perfect for him when I'm gone. And I'm just wondering at this point what I've been scared of hospice. I mean, it's a scary idea. It's a scary word, okay?
Indeed.
And that's where you go to die as far as, you know. Anyway, so I need to know what hospice care can do for me.
Okay.
Because things are becoming impossible. Even though I have in-home support service, I have...
Let me just ask you to do something, okay?
Yeah.
I want you to call back and give your home number to my producer. And I will give you a personal call, and we'll just hash this out off the air. Because right now, I can just hear the amount of pressure you're under. My heart aches for you. But this isn't something that we want to do in a public venue. And secondly,
okay.
You need to shut off the phone and be with your family right now. And I'll give you a call in a couple hours, okay?
Okay, that's fine.
All right, so call back and leave your number with the producer, and then I'll get back to you, okay?
All right, thanks, doctor.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Let's go to Jamie and Bonnie Doon. Hello, Jamie, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. I really appreciate your compassion and your understanding of your callers. That's really cool how you handle that. For me, I keep on having this phrase going through my mind, and the phrase is profit at the expense of human suffering. And I've always had trouble with people that are gaining more than they really need for in any situation, even professional athletes. And I was wondering, you know, when will the populace, the majority of people, realize this and actually act on it in a more popular way? And I guess the end result would be national health care or socialized medicine, whatever, where everyone deserves the medicine and everyone deserves the opportunity to get it, you know, like exists in some other countries. So I was wondering what your take on that was, profit at the expense of human suffering.
Well, it's a good phrase. Obviously, it can apply to everything from arms manufacturers to people who are, you know, so-called profiteering, people who are lodging false charges against the Medicare system. There's a whole lot of people who could have that rubric applied. But I like the deeper aspect of your question, because it tells me a lot about who you are, that you frame it the way you frame it. And I'm afraid that I may be maybe a little older or maybe a little bit more cynical. I actually agree with your statement, but I don't think that you state a universally held value. And one of the things that has happened to me in the last 5 years, watching this debate emerge, well, almost since the Clintons, but definitely in the last 5 years, is I've come to realize that our society, the United States at least, actually has a different set of values than most of the world. And it's much more of a value on independence and freedom, to the extent that your price of freedom is that if you are wounded, if you're weak, if you're the slow member of the herd, well, that's your tough luck. That's the price of freedom. And there's not the kind of emphasis on interdependence that I see in other societies, like, for example, Canada, United Kingdom, even France. They're much more, well, they're not much more homogenous societies. Obviously, both France and England have lots of immigrants to deal with. But there is a different predicate in the social discourse in those countries, which has more to do with the fact that women and children first, you know, we help the weak. The strong have a duty to help the weak and not just work for their own benefit. And that's kind of missing from our social discourse. at a level that makes me wonder, I don't quite know where it went. I'm not sure we ever had it, but I definitely can't remember any time in my adult life when that wasn't being labeled as evil liberalism, that that wasn't pejorative. The idea that maybe the strong and the rich owed something to the weak and the poor has been, for some reason, framed in our culture as delusional, as a bad idea, as something that's going to interfere with America being great, which in my opinion is just nonsense, but yet that's the way it's framed. So I'm going to stay here and fight the good fight and try to make things better, but I also understand that it's an uphill fight because as a society, I don't think we've really made the decision that we need to help each other. I really think that that is still open to question, which is, of course, for a species that's essentially a herd species is nuts, but hey, we're nuts. We're crazy in this country, and I don't know that that's going to get any better anytime soon.
I totally get what you're saying, and for me, I feel like I'm willing to sacrifice even what I make. Like, I'm a teacher, right? Elementary school teacher, and if I were to have to give up 3% of my salary on furlough days to help other people have jobs, I really don't mind doing that. I know that I might even have to give up more in the future, but I've never been much of a materialist or a consumer in my life, being a flower child. I actually am probably older than you.
Jerry, you're a subversive. It's clear. You're a liberal. You're delusional. You think that we should be helping all of those illegal immigrants, don't you? I'm pretending to be on AM talk radio.
Well, that's
folks.
Who I work with. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I work with them.
And of course, you know, it's the children of these immigrants who are going to be the people that pay for my Medicare and my Social Security, and I'm really glad they're here. But to some people, there's just a disconnect. They don't see themselves as being part of an ecology.
Well, yeah. It's the xenophobia. And I know this is becoming more of a social commentary than a medical commentary, but I really do appreciate the fact that, sister, you know, that you're there, and I your producer is a good human being, and it gives you hope when you resonate with other people that believe in the same thing. I mean, it's just a matter of gaining a groundswell of other people that are willing to step up and voice their opinion and actually vote and do the active things that will make the changes in our society.
Maybe we can start a healthcare cooperative. What do you think?
I think that'd be a great idea.
And we can make it work a lot better. And maybe we could promote it to the healthy liberals out there who are actually doing their jogging. And as a result, we'll have favorable selection. We can do a kind of, you know, a green healthcare plan. And we can make it so that it subsidizes people who are low income. And therefore, there's kind of a feel-good factor about joining this collective.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe we can make that work for us. I bet you there's more liberals out there who are willing to raise their hand and help other people than I think.
I think there are, actually. I think people are just a little, they're scared because they, you know, they want to take care of their own first.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm just discouraged. I mean, this whole thing has been a lot of expectations dashed for me, and I have to admit I'm reacting a little bit emotionally.
Me too. But keep on the good, I don't want to say fight or battle. I hate to.
Yeah. It's not a fight. It's a struggle.
Well, thank you again.
And thank you for your hard work teaching the young people who are going to, like I said, be the people paying for my Medicare and Social Security. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
We had an off-air call wanting to know more about natural anti-inflammatories. I'll do that real quick before I take the next caller. Natural anti-inflammatories come in a couple of categories. They are things that interfere with the development of compound in the cells called NF-kappa-B. Hops derivatives are very good at this. Green tea has catechins which do this. And turmeric or curcuminoids, which are the newest, hottest version. There are also things like boswellia, which is a natural anti-inflammatory. So there's a number of these things, and they're effective because they interfere with the elaboration of prostaglandins at the molecular cellular level. So in other words, at the level of DNA, you don't make the NF-kappa-B, you don't upregulate the inflammatory compounds, and so you have less inflammation. Another way of doing that is by blocking the enzymes, COX-1 and COX-2, and some of these compounds are also natural COX inhibitors. Ibuprofen and all of the non-steroidals act as COX inhibitors, COX-1 and COX-2, which stands for cyclooxygenase, so that's why the COX is the abbreviation for that. And then you get into the essential fatty acids, which are a different type of natural anti-inflammatory. What the essential fatty acids, particularly the omega-3 fatty acids, do is they ensure that the prostaglandins, which are manufactured, are less powerful inflammatory signals than if you're eating a diet high in omega-6 fatty acids. Those are stronger anti-inflammatory signals, so you get more burn, if you will, per match, and that's what we're talking about. The end result of using a combination of natural inflammatories and also eating an anti-inflammatory diet can be really significant for some patients, and I always encourage a trial of it for about a month in anyone who's finding themselves needing to eat non-steroidal anti-inflammatories on a daily basis. Moving right along to the caller, this is Jerry in SoCal. And Jerry, I bet you could tell me a thing or two about non-steroidal anti-inflammatories.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, Dr. Don. Thank you for taking my call. It's been a great show so far.
Thanks. So far, I like that.
Yeah, we'll see what happens here.
Very scientific viewpoint. Okay.
Views on my situation, my case so far. My case is about my right hip. I've got pretty bad osteoarthritis there, and it's a little bit unusual. I started having problems about a year ago, and I have one doctor has said is rapidly deteriorating osteoarthritis. I went from like a normal hip joint space to about only 1 millimeter of joint space now on a good portion of the top. And so now I guess I'm in the point of where I'm having to shop for some sort of a hip replacement. Going to get to the point where it's bone on bone real soon. So,
mm-hmm. How old are you?
I'm 60, but I'm very active. I'm still employed, and I want to continue that.
Mm-hmm. Well, hip replacement is undergoing a bit of a revolution at the moment. Sounds superficially to be a good candidate for a resurfacing. And, mm-hmm. You know, the cartilage is gone. You're 60. So you could buy yourself perhaps 10 to 15 years with a hip resurfacing. And then when that resurfacing wore down, either the technology would have improved or you'd be a candidate for a total hip. And as you undoubtedly know, total hips have a lifetime of about 15 years as well.
Yeah.
Less if you're really active. By then, though, we've bought you 30 years, so now you're 90, and that might do it, you know, in terms of not having to undergo a third procedure because you have developed an, I mean, sorry to say, but you've exceeded your use-by date by the time you're 90, and so it may be a moot point. One of the things that might be available for you is something called a Birmingham hip resurfacing. We've talked about this on the show as well, and the website is www.birminghamhipresurfacing, just like it sounds, Birmingham the city, hip resurfacing, all lowercase, .com. You might look into that. I do not receive any funding or otherwise have any involvement with this website. It's completely non-commercial, pointing you in the direction of something you might find suitable. This is done in the Bay Area. You're in SoCal, so you would be able to do it without traveling too far. And this is perhaps a better solution for a younger person who's looking for a bridge, so to speak. As far as regrowing cartilage, you know, that's the holy grail here on orthopedics, is can we replace the cartilage, transplant it, punch holes in it, and seed it with stem cells? All of those things are currently in phase 3 clinical trials. They're being done. What we don't have is 5-year data or 10-year data to tell us if it's worth doing.
I've actually investigated the hip resurfacing technology, and I'm focusing on finding a doctor to do that.
Yes.
There are so many specific questions that I'd like to ask to really select a good surgeon. Do you think that, this is kind of a personal question about doctors, are doctors offended when you ask lots of questions like, how would you place the acetabular cup? How would you determine the correct amount of bone to take off? You know, yeah. how many hip femoral neck fractures, you know, those kind of specific things.
Well, first of all, I applaud you for having done your homework and being ready to ask those questions. And second of all, I would say that you have to think in terms of personality fit. Some doctors will be busy and they will have their eye on their procedure fee and not on their humanitarian mission, and they may be very impatient with those questions and really not want to answer them because you're getting in the way of their profit margin. And in that situation, you run the other way. Another doctor may have employed a health educator to sit down and go through some of the basic questions with you just to save them time and then meet with you to cover those things that the health educator can't do. I think that's a completely legitimate approach. Practically speaking, I believe that's how it should be done because I get a little impatient sometimes and not all doctors are great educators. In general, if you're a proceduralist, you may not be very good at people skills or you may be not so focused on dumbing down, and you wouldn't need it, but just for other patients, you know, kind of explaining things to somebody who never even took high school science can get a little bit difficult. And there's a special skill to that. As someone who's highly skilled in doing that, I can tell you that there's a trick to it and you get better with practice. If you're not interested in doing that, you're going to be lousy at it. So finding a surgeon for you that is willing to sit down and talk with you, who's perhaps, you know, loves to brag and talk about procedures and go into the details, that's the person you're looking for. You will find him or her. Because that's a fairly common demographic. And so you search around till you find the person who will sit down with you and talk it all over with you. And that's the person you want to work on your hip.
Would it be better to do that verbally? Or I have like about 25 questions I want to ask. Would it be like...
It would be better to do it verbally because doctors can't get paid for anything but FaceTime. And we don't get paid much for that. Yeah. If the doctor is willing to do it electronically, that's basically a free service. So it just is going to vary a lot with what people are willing to do. You know, you can be eaten alive doing, you know, free electronic stuff, and many doctors are just very scared that that's going to happen to them, so they don't even do it at all. But I would start with a visit. Do you have a seminar? Do you have health educators who will talk with me about this before I come into the doctor? A lot of times doctors are doing a presentation, an hour-long slideshow presentation that might answer a lot of your specific questions. You know, I know several doctors who do that on a monthly basis. And yes, it's promotional. They're promoting their work, but on the other hand, they're providing a good educational service and it's free.
Yeah, it's quite a difficult task to be a consumer in the health market.
Well, the health market isn't used to having actual consumers. It's used to having other people make purchase decisions and then providing the service. What you're looking for, however, isn't unavailable. It's just going to take some hunting.
Fortunately, I've got a few months, probably like 6-8 months to do it, so I'm going to be selective.
Well, there you go. Okay, good luck to you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Dunn.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Someone asked a question if there is a generic Viagra, and I was just checking to see. I don't think so. And I was just looking to see here if I had the number of years until Viagra will be available as a generic, but my little cheat book here does not carry that information. You need to take the year it was approved and add 17 and then hope the company doesn't come up with some kind of dodge to allow them to lengthen the duration of their product. Now, in terms of generic Viagra, my producer just did a search on the web and tells me that the web does show lots of sites claiming to sell generic Viagra, but these are online pharmacies that are often spammers. The quality is suspect, and these are probably all counterfeit. The United States patent is still protected, so if it's being touted as generic Viagra, it's being manufactured illicitly in a factory in some other country and then sold online. There's a lot of that going around, and I would strongly recommend against purchasing any of that stuff. Viagra alone, by the way, is not something that you want to just purchase and start taking, guys. Because if you're having difficulty with your erections, you should view that with the same level of suspicion as if you're running and you get some chest pain. Now, if you're a sensible person and you're running and you get chest pain, you stop running and you wait. And then the next time you're running and you get chest pain, then you think to yourself, maybe I should see a doctor, and you do. So if you've been humming along with perfectly normal erections and they stop being as hard, as strong, as firm, or as durable, and that is a fairly consistent change and not just circumstantial, you need to view that as the canary in the coal mine. Something's wrong with the blood flow. And the very first place in males that early endothelial disease, that is to say early clogging of the arteries, will show up is in the erections. So I and many other doctors, if a man comes requesting that agent, we'll do screening tests. We'll get a screening cholesterol. We'll make them run on a treadmill because we're worried about clogged arteries to more than just the location that's brought the patient in. And not having that investigation and then taking this, even whatever stuff you can buy online, which is maybe not even Viagra in the first place, but even if it were, you're taking your life in your hands. That's nuts. You need to view that as a warning sign that there may be something wrong with you and get that investigated first. A couple more emails. Osman in Delaware writes, I recently found out I have shortness of breath. The results of my blood test shows that my red blood cells are 5.6, which is high. Hemoglobin 16.9, a little bit high, and hematocrit 49.8 with normal platelets. 2 days ago, I had a sleep apnea test, and I have yet to have the result. I'm afraid I have cancer. What can you tell me? Thank you. Well, Osman, it sounds to me like you may have a condition called polycythemia vera, which is where you make too many red blood cells. And those red blood cells thicken your blood, I guess is the easiest way to think of it. So it is harder for blood to move through small capillary beds, including potentially the small capillary beds of your lungs. It also is harder for your heart to pump the blood because it's thicker. You can imagine, let's say, an oil pump in a car. It's harder for that if the oil is extra viscous or the wrong viscosity for the pump. You can get into trouble by straining the pump. Typically, this is treated by simply bloodletting, oddly enough. Works quite well. Just remove some of the blood. Stay ahead of the system. And it isn't a cancer per se. It's a broken Xerox machine in the bone marrow. You're making too many red blood cells. But it's not a cancer in the way that we think of cancer as something that's invasive, that's going to eat your brain or eat your liver, end your life. So I want to reassure you that in most cases of cancer, what you see is elevated white blood cells. And while you don't give me your white blood cells, I'm assuming since you didn't give them to me that they were normal. So blood cancers would have elevated white blood cells most of the time, or extremely low white blood cells at the very, very end stage. I don't see that in the results you've given me. And yes, I think whenever one is having difficulty, if you're past a certain age, the very first thing that comes to mind is cancer. Cancer is the Satan of our era. It is the evil. This is the great evil. It is the great Satan. And we're all afraid of cancer at a level that is highly emotional and not intellectually derived, let's say. It's coming from a different part of the brain. I want to wish you well, and if you want to get back to me with more information, then I'll let you know. So, we've got time for one more quick email before the end of the program. This is Marion in Carmel. He had an incident of coughing up a fair amount of blood. Marion has been choking on food a little bit, especially if she's talking or moving or eating at the same time. And she usually has to cough before she gets a small piece of food out. One of those times she coughed up blood. She's wondering if she needs to worry about it. She also mentions she's had a sore feeling in her chest for a couple of years, but it's just kind of there and doesn't get better or worse. So, Marion, I'm concerned that you have a mechanical blockage in your esophagus. Certainly what you're describing could be consistent with a stricture, which is a benign process, but it could also be consistent with a malignant process. The minimalist approach would be to wait until it recurs. I wouldn't advise that. A medium approach would be to obtain a study called a barium swallow and look at esophageal motility. If there is a web or something pushing the esophagus in, that will show it up. If that was negative, then I think you could wait 6 months or so and see if it is continuing to worsen. An aggressive approach, which is probably what you will get if you have health care insurance and a standard medical advice, would be an endoscopy and a bronchoscopy. And those procedures would, in fact, reliably rule out anything dangerous and tell you that this is something that you don't have to worry about. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. Thank you for all of your emails. Thank you for your calls. I appreciate all of the input, and I want to urge you to go to our website, askdrdon.com. This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.